This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Gary Stewart. He is the author of The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer. Gary Stewart, who was abandoned by his father in 1963 on the steps of a downtown building, says that the man who was the Zodiac Killer was his biological father. He's written about it, and we'll talk with him. Also, Matt Letourneau, he is the Director of Communications for the U.S. Chambers Institute for 21st Century Energy. Matt will comment on President Obama's energy outlook. And Smiley Gray Anders Jr., the venerable columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate, celebrating 35 years with his column. We'll talk with Smiley. But now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside our area, please call 877-217-5757 toll free, and you may reach us by email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. We start with Gary Stewart. His book is The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer. A major publishing house, HarperCollins, has published this book with Gary Stewart and Susan Mustafa. And it is a remarkable ride. It starts with Gary Stewart, 1963. He's born on the 12th of February. And Gary, good morning to you. What happens after your birth?
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me on the show. Well, after my birth, I was actually born in New Orleans, and ended up in Baton Rouge. Part of the story, being born from fugitive parents from San Francisco, and as far as I knew, as a young child from about the age of five, where my mother and father told me about being adopted, to the day I turned 39 years old and had my biological mother contact me, I just grew up in a normal, loving South Louisiana home.
You were abandoned in downtown Baton Rouge.
Right. My parents were on the run. My mother was 14 at the time they married in Reno. And that being a statutory crime, they were on the run for love, and the San Francisco Chronicle did a great job of chronicling their love affair. They called it the ice cream romance because they met in an ice cream parlor. My father was 27, so there's the problem. They ended up in New Orleans, broke, desperate, about 9 months into their last flight for love. And when I was 4 weeks old, my father took me by train on the old Southern Belle, that passenger line that used to run between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, and exited the Pullman car at the old Baton Rouge train depot, walked seven blocks up North Boulevard, and laid me down on the stairwell landing in the Lytle apartment building.
And you recently had a photo taken on that stairwell.
I did. You know, Jim, that place has become such a place of transition and renaissance and rebirth for me, right? It's where my old self died and where I was able to be adopted by the Stewart family.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk with Gary Stewart, who grew up in Baton Rouge after being abandoned by his father. And he lived 39 years, and then his biological mother contacts him. How did that happen?
You know, the records for adoptions in Louisiana were closed, sealed in the 70s. So being born in the 60s, even though my records may have been available at one time, they were sealed in the 70s. So I couldn't search for my mother or my biological father if I wanted to. I didn't even have a name to go by. My mother got creative in an adoption reunion search group and found someone here in the state of Louisiana that was willing to, if not break the seal, look under the seal and get enough identifying information to give her a strong lead. So she contacted me.
And your mother, before we get to your infamous father, your mother was quite a remarkable lady in her own right.
Yeah, actually, she, you know, as a juvenile runaway and, you know, subsequently mother, the police officers who eventually caught up with her in the French Quarter described her as clever and cunning, and she's very sharp. She was mature beyond her physical years, and evidently visually mature and stunning beyond her years, hence why my father assumed she was much older when they met.
And later in life, long after your father was, your biological father was gone, your mother married a person very high in the ranks of government in San Francisco.
Yeah, actually, what a twist in the story, certainly unexpected. 11 years after my mother's life with my father and me, she went on to marry the first ever African-American homicide inspector in the history of the San Francisco Police Department. He actually was an inspector on the Zodiac case. And then later in life, before his retirement and his passing in 98, he was really good friends with the many of the politicians there in San Francisco and ended up serving as deputy mayor under Willie Brown, Dianne Feinstein, and all of those people who are still wonderful friends with my biological mother today. So my mother lived the life of San Francisco's elite social people.
297-5633 is your number. The book is The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer, Gary Stewart and Susan Mustafa. Gary's our guest. His father, his biological dad, was a character named Earl Van Best Jr. Born in Wilmore, Kentucky in 1934, he would have been 80 years old had he lived a full life. He died at 50. When did you find out that he was your biological father?
It took about 2 years after I first met my biological mother, which happened in 2002. I asked her immediately because that reunion with her gave me such a sense of completeness in my life as an adopted child wanting to know. At first, when she told me that he had taken me by train and taken me away from her, I immediately told her I didn't want to know this guy, right? I grew up with a dad who would never turn his back on his son. So I said, you know, I'm not interested in knowing this guy. But that only lasted 6 months with me. And in the latter part of 2002, I went back to her. I said, you know what, Mom? I really do want to find my biological father. And she set out to help. Of course, the first people she contacted were her husband's former co-workers at the San Francisco Police Department. What better place to find a missing person? And with 6 months later, in about June of 2003, one of her friends in Internal Affairs came back with my father's name, date of birth, place of birth, and Social Security number.
And you found out, I presume shortly thereafter, that your father had died.
It didn't take long to run with every lead and every clue that I had just based on that, right? It was the beginning of the end of dial-up and the beginning of high-speed internet. So I did have resources to do my search. And soon I found out that my father was deceased and that he had also left three children and a former wife abandoned in Vienna, Austria. When I set out to try to contact those half-siblings, because what I wanted was a family photo around the Christmas tree or something, I didn't have a photo of my father other than a 1962 old DMV photo that was provided to me by Sergeant Butler in Internal Affairs, and I wanted to see a more recent picture and have a picture of what my siblings looked like. And that was the beginning of my frustrations with not having everything in my father's file to help me in my search.
Well, as you piece together the fabric of his life, whether you believe the story or not regarding him being the Zodiac Killer, Van Earl Best Jr. had a notorious past. In fact, 10 days after you were born, he was arrested for rape.
Correct. He did. Prior to his time with my mother and their romance, I later found out that my father was actually granted a divorce from his first teenage wife in 1959, but on the grounds of extreme cruelty and inhuman treatment. He also, according to the police reports in New Orleans and Baton Rouge and my mother's statement, that he would close me up in his footlocker or trunk because he couldn't stand to hear it cry. And then, of course, he was arrested for the rape of underage rape of a female mm-hmm. with my mother.
Well, at what point, Gary Stewart, did you determine that he might be the Zodiac Killer?
Jim, finally, out of frustration and my half-siblings in Austria asking for more proof that I was, in fact, Earl Van Best Jr.'s first son, I went to my mother and asked her to beg her friends in the SFPD for that information in the file. I literally said at one point, I don't care if he killed JFK. He's dead now. It's not going to hurt his reputation. I just have to know. They told my mother what was in that file was so heinous that it would destroy me, and that what he had done to me as an infant and my mother would make what he had done later in life would make what he had done to me and my mother seem inconsequential. They asked my mother, they encouraged her to have me just drop this thing with your father, and so I did, Jim. I did, and 3 months later, watching an A&E cold case documentary on the Zodiac Killer, who I didn't know anything about, I see the wanted poster, the wanted sketch of the Zodiac Killer from 1969, and my heart stops. And my son looks at the screen. He says, "Hey, Dad, it's you." And I go back into my office to pull out that old DMV photo of my father, the only photo I had, which I later learned that it was his mugshot from his 1962 rape of my mother that I had framed as inspiration to help me find this man. I went back in the living room and I told Zach, I said, "It's not me, Zach. It's my father." That was the first inclination.
And then what did you do?
Well, immediately after I got over the emotional roller coaster that I just ran into something so horrific I wouldn't know how to deal with, I wrote my mother and I wrote Sergeant Butler in Internal Affairs, and I said, "I think I know what you guys have been covering up or hiding from me, and I think I found out why, and I think my father was a Zodiac Killer, and I'll be glad to visit you tomorrow in San Francisco to discuss it." But in the meantime, I said, "I'm going to prove that this can't possibly be. It's just a terrible coincidence that my father happens to look exactly like the sketch of the Zodiac Killer." So I set out on a mission to disprove my worst fear, and over the course of the next 10 years, I would prove beyond any doubt in my mind that there is no way I could exonerate my father as the Zodiac Killer.
And before we get into the evidence that you've unearthed that you believe is compelling enough to say definitively that your father is the Zodiac Killer, the Zodiac Killer was a pretty bad guy, wasn't he?
He remains today America's version of Jack the Ripper. I believe he was a copycat of Jack the Ripper, who operated in London in the 1880s. He is the most notorious and still at large serial killer in American history. And his signature was, I guess, what gave him all the notoriety, which was not only the statement, "This is the Zodiac speaking," the name he gave himself, but it was the letters and the arrogance with which he bragged to police that they would never catch him. And they never did.
The book is The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father, and finding the Zodiac Killer. We'll return with Gary L. Stewart after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest is Gary Stewart. He lives in Baton Rouge. He's an engineer by trade, and he has written a book about his life, which started in a most unusual way. He was born in New Orleans, abandoned about a month later in Baton Rouge on the steps of a building on North Boulevard. And when he's 39 years old, he learns who his biological mother is. Shortly thereafter, finds out who his biological father is, and he has put the pieces together and believes there is no doubt that his father, Van Earl Best Jr., was the Zodiac Killer, a notorious serial killer in California who started his reign of terror in the 1960s, late 1960s. How many people did he kill?
Five victims, but yet bragged of many more that have never been proved.
And as you say, the killings were remarkable in their simplicity.
Right. Nothing sophisticated, but the things that made this serial killer so unique was the after the fact, what he did. Several times he would phone the police department or families, victims' families, and make his statement that he was the one who did it and give them details. By the way, Jim, just as he did when he abandoned me in Baton Rouge, the very next morning on March 16, 1963, he called Ms. Mary Bonnet, who was the resident who found me, and claimed that he had left his son on that stairwell.
So I'm basically owning up to what he had done to you, and you say in a kind of an odd way, owning up to killing these people. He did it with guns, right?
Some. He stabbed others, and they were all personal, but by guns and by knife.
And some people got away.
Yeah, there are survivors. Two men, Brian Hartnell and Michael Majot, are the male survivors. All of the females that were attacked died, except for one woman who he picked up and gave for a rather interesting ride of fear, who jumped out of his car and got away.
How did they get the sketch of it?
The sketch came from his last known killing in San Francisco, the only crime in San Francisco, where he murdered yellow cab driver Paul Stein. My father, after serving time for his crimes on the run with my mother and myself, spent 20 months in in San Quentin State Prison. Afterwards, he had, the limited things you can do once you come out of prison. I don't know if there were work release programs, but one thing he did, he joined the Teamsters and started driving a cab. There's no doubt in my mind he knew Paul Stein, the cab driver.
All right. So we've got a sketch of him, and by virtue of the fact that he wrote these letters, we have handwriting.
Right, and sorry, back to the sketch. When he shot Paul Stein in Presidio Heights, that evening there were teenagers who saw him, phoned in an emergency call, and gave a description. Later, one of the responding officers actually saw him leaving the crime scene and later revised that sketch. So we know we have a very accurate account of who committed that crime in Presidio Heights. Then we have the letters, of course, taunting the police, taking credit for what he had gotten away with.
And how were you able to compare the handwriting in those letters to other handwriting? What did you have as a document?
We We actually had four documents, and I am not a certified document examiner by any stretch of the means, but I know when I saw all of the samples of my father's writing, my heart just stopped. The similarities were, to me, just not coincidental. So Susan Mustafa, my co-author, enlisted the help of a question document examiner, someone who's an expert in the field, and his findings were that he was virtually certain that the author of those documents known to have been written by my father were a virtual match to the author of the Zodiac letters.
Ariana asks, is there any blood evidence?
You know, Jim, not that I know of. I know there's certainly DNA evidence, and I know the technology, since the last attempt at extracting a full profile for the Zodiac killer, is now available. He wrote letters. He possibly licked the stamps and the envelopes. There's DNA inside the gloves that he had inside of Paul Stein's cab. There's other touch DNA on other crimes he committed. So that's out there, but no blood evidence or blood typing that I've been made aware of.
Could his body be exhumed?
You know, absolutely not. But and the reason being, he was buried in an unmarked grave in Mexico City, the poorest cemetery in the poorest neighborhood of all of Mexico City. That was 1984. Because his wife, former wife at the time, living in Austria, did not hold that grave in perpetuity, didn't pay the money to have it held, he has been remains have been interred into his same grave two more times since his original burial. And speaking to the director of services there, the last time they removed the bag that contained his remains, there was nothing left, so they just threw it away. But that's not necessary, Jim. My biological mother submitted her DNA, and I submitted my DNA to a genetic lab, and we have extracted a full genetic profile of my father.
So you believe the evidence is definitive, that he is your father. But that's probably not in doubt. So, but how do we know for sure, Gary, that he is the Zodiac killer?
I guess nowadays, Jim, it's going to come down to DNA. It's going to come down to science. I believe they can extract something that he had contact with, whether it's a stamp or a glove or a rope. You know, he tied his victims up from time or two, and those items are still in evidence. And then compare that to my father's actual DNA. Okay. There are many more things, Jim, that we haven't even gotten around discussing. Like, one thing the Zodiac did in his letters to the authorities was to say, you know what, you think you've cracked this cipher, but if you crack this cipher, you'll have my identity. For the first time in the 40-something year history of this case, I have found a man whose name perfectly fits without any letter or character substitutions in the three ways he wrote his names in three separate ciphers for the first time.
And who is that?
E.V. Best Jr., Earl Van Best Jr., and Earl Van Best Jr. He insisted his name was in the ciphers, and I have presented that. And at one point in time, prior to DNA, the evidence that I've provided to the SFPD would have been enough, according to our friend, mutual friend, Tony Clayton, who mentioned to Susan Mustafa just the other day. The information that Gary has is enough to close this case, and we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Nicholas on Nicholson, Gary, says, are you capitalizing on this crime?
Absolutely not, Jim. I've been in business here in Baton Rouge and am a fairly successful businessman and family man here in the community. The last thing any person on earth would want to do would be to write a book about solving the Zodiac case, right? That's been done before. Every other book about the Zodiac case has been someone that's had a favorite person of interest in mind and set out to prove their theory or capitalize on whatever moment of fame, notoriety they may have. I am the only author, the only son, the only relative in the world who actually set out on an honest, completely naive at times, journey to find my true identity. And I believe I have a life's purpose, to have been born into this incredible story and not to share what God's done for me in taking me back on the stairwell landing from the hands of evil and placing me into the heart of love of the Stewart family. I felt like it was my duty, my life's purpose, to share this story.
Now, your grandfather, his funeral was at Arlington Cemetery, right?
Another one of those reasons why, you know, Nicholas, I just had to share this story. My grandfather, as it later turns out, was a great, great man, a great minister of faith who dropped his mission field efforts in 1941 to go back home and join the Navy as a chaplain because he wanted to defend his country. He later became friends with most of the presidents in the 60s and the 70s until his death, was a very good friend of John F. Kennedy, shared many Thanksgiving dinners with Gene Autry, the actor, singer, former soldier. My grandfather was an incredible man, and to have this happen and this to be his biggest regret, and it just seems another reason why I had to share my story.
But if your story is right, you have the genes of a serial killer coursing through you.
Boy, you know, that's not the first time I've been reminded of that. One thing I've come to realize over the course of the past couple of years, I believe my father was born to loving parents. I believe my father was gravely affected by the divorce that occurred between my grandfather and my grandmother, his mom and dad, at a very early age, and my grandmother was very promiscuous, and my father actually witnessed, without his father in the home, how his mother allowed men, just any man off the street, to abuse and take advantage of her. And I believe my father had such a rage against his mother and the fact that his father had abandoned him, and later my mother abandoning my father and leaving him in the French Quarter. I believe my father was nurtured into the evil that he became. I believe my whole story is a case study of nature versus nurture, including the Gary L. Stewart part with the same genetic makeup of his father, who was, thank God, by the grace of God, raised in a loving home where love, unconditional acceptance, and forgiveness are the way we were raised.
Gary, thank you for sharing your story, and I'm sure we'll have occasion to talk again. You're an exceptionally good guest, and it's quite a ride. The Most Dangerous Animal of All, from HarperCollins, a nationwide story that I'm sure is bound to sell a lot of books, and many people will know about your story, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks for having me, Jim.
Take care. 297-5633. We switch gears, and the new carbon pollution rules the Obama administration announced on Monday will help spur the natural gas industry and renewable energy like wind and solar power. But the New York Times reports executives and analysts say they did not see the nation's reliance on coal disappearing anytime soon. The intent of the Environmental Protection Agency proposal to reduce carbon pollution from the nation's power plants by 30% by 2030 is to reduce the dependence on coal, which today generates about 40% of our electricity in the United States. With us to talk about this and more is Matt Letourneau. He is the Senior Director of Communications at the U.S. Chamber's Institute for 21st Century Energy. Good morning, Matt.
Hi, Jim. I'm actually, I talked to your producer about this. My name is Heath Nockmus, and I'm the Senior Director of Policy
Where is Matt?
Matt is our communications guy, and he actually set up this interview for me.
All right. Okay. Well, then I tell you what, then we will switch gears and talk with you, my friend. What's your take on this?
Our take is that it will be very costly for America. It will cost a lot of jobs. It will reduce household income. And it's something that is moving too fast, too quickly, and at the end of the day is not going to do anything if indeed this is meant to tackle a global problem. We did a study on this, on a potential way that these carbon pollutions would play out, and then the pollution standards came out on Monday. And either way, depending whether you go by our study or by the rule that came out on Monday, at the end of the day, after all the coal plant retirements and the increased costs, global greenhouse gas emissions will either be lowered by about 1.35% or as much as 1.8% pursuant to the study we released last week. So essentially, it doesn't really do anything if this is indeed a national or an international global issue. It does nothing on that front, but it does reduce our global competitiveness pretty severely.
Do you acknowledge we have some problems with carbon emissions?
I would not say that there's necessarily problems. I mean, we advocate for the most efficient, cleanest burning coal out there. I mean, there are there's a carbon capture and sequestration plant being built right now next door in Mississippi, and we are fully supportive of those efforts. And the industry that is designing those technologies also says that putting these kind of rules in place, and along with the new source standard that was introduced last September that bans new coal-fired power plants, essentially without this carbon capture technology, which is not proven yet, with those rules tend to make the development of cleaner emission technology for coal much less likely.
Well, the headline in the New York Times yesterday says Democrats in coal country run from EPA. Obviously, this is a political issue in many states, and this is an election year. Your take on this?
Well, I think down in Louisiana, you're gonna most likely see a fair amount of that. That is definitely the case. I mean, the policies of this administration are seem to consistently be against coal country. And so if you are a Democrat incumbent or, of course, a Democrat seeking to gain a seat in a state that is either more reliant on coal or is a larger producer of coal, I can certainly understand why you would not necessarily want to get close to the current president and his administration's policies with respect to coal.
Well, there are those in the environmental community who believe the president hasn't gone far enough.
And we will continue to see that, and quite honestly, I don't think that there is anything we could do that would be far enough in that community. I mean, they will always ask for more. A lot of this rule aims at shifting our coal generation to natural gas. Well, a lot of the environmental groups have already come out and said that they want us to stop using natural gas as well.
297-5633. We'll return with this conversation and also hear from the venerable Smiley Anders. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. A few more minutes with Heath Nockmus. He is the Senior Policy Director for the Institute for the 21st Century from the United States Chamber of Commerce. And is it fair to say, Heath, that your organization is primarily one that views things from a conservative bent when it comes to the environment?
You cut out at one moment. Are you asking if the administration views
things? No, I'm asking if your group is one that by nature is one that is not going to be in sync with a Democratic president, no matter who he or she might be, on environmental issues.
It quite honestly depends on what is being done. I mean, our mission is to unify policymakers, regulators, business leaders, and the American public behind a common sense energy strategy. And we want to keep America secure, prosperous, and clean. If policies are introduced that help business, help our competitiveness, we will naturally be supportive of those. And there are certainly many policies in various areas of the government where we are supportive of what sometimes what the administration does, what Congress does, and the like. There are other areas, and the environmental area with respect to coal-fired power plants, which support about 40% of the electric generation in this country, where the policies are rather one-sided, and they're not very holistic in what we need to do to both balance environmental improvement and supporting our economy, and frankly, still coming out of the Great Recession.
There are what, about 600 coal-fired plants in the country? Is that right?
It's something like that, yeah. And depending on whether you're talking about coal units or coal plants, there are a lot of them. And right now, because of existing EPA regulations that don't include these carbon rules that came out on Monday, there's about 60 to 80 gigawatts of coal that's slated to close. And in our study, we found that with similar regulations to those introduced on Monday, another about 114 gigawatts of coal will be retired. And overall, that's about 40% of the entire coal fleet in this country. And again, that's what accounts for about 40% of our power today.
Now, the EPA rule, it's to be finalized in a year, and there is a public comment period. So each state will have some flexibility, correct?
The EPA is saying that, and the reason they're very much forced into saying that because the section of the Clean Air Act under which this rule is promulgated requires the states to essentially take the lead in developing their individual state program. The EPA sort of sets the guidelines, and then the states are supposed to set the program. Now, we don't know at this point what the EPA will do and what kind of flexibility they will actually permit at that point, so that remains to be seen.
297-5633, a few more minutes with Heath Nockmus, the Senior Policy Director for the U.S. Chambers Institute for 21st Century Energy, not happy about President Obama and his approach to energy policy, which was unveiled on Monday. Nick downtown, good morning. You're on the air with Heath Nockmus. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Jim, I just thought that it was interesting that a lot of these groups that seem to oppose expanding our energy portfolio at the same time want cheap gas and want us out of Afghanistan. We can't have it both ways. We need to develop our energy so we have homeland security. They're connected.
All right. Your response, Heath?
I very much agree that we need to develop our own national resources, and we have about 250 years of coal-fired power plant or coal available in this country. It's not something we need to import from anywhere. The same is with respect to the development of shale and emerging gas and oil technologies. I mean, we are, in spite of this administration, developing a much greater energy abundance within the borders of our nation than we had even 4 or 5 years ago.
All right, a question from a listener, Richard in Gonzales, wanting to know your position on the Keystone Pipeline.
That's not one of the issues that I specialize in here at the chamber. But we are supportive of the pipeline, and we are supportive of energy infrastructure in general. It's one of the things that has become very difficult to site in this country. I mean, infrastructure in general, the gas pipelines, electric transmission lines. These are all things that are needed. I mean, even if you are only an advocate of renewable energy, windmills and the like, you still need transmission lines to bring those resources, which are typically located remote from where the electricity is needed, to cities and urban areas. And the Keystone Pipeline is just, an oil-based version of that. There are pipelines crisscrossing this country everywhere, and that is just that's an example of the politics of an infrastructure infrastructure project getting way, way beyond the actual impacts of the project.
Heath Nockmus, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Jim. Have
Take
a great
care.
Day.
You too. And we're joined in studio by Smiley Gray Anders Jr., who today celebrates his 35th anniversary as a daily columnist with the Baton Rouge Advocate. His column reads, if you haven't seen it, thanks for 35 years of stories. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
35 years. You probably remember June 4th, 1979, as though it were yesterday.
Yeah, I had been on the Advocate business desk, and one of the editors told me they were going to start a little column that was based on the Herb Cain column that he did for the Chronicle for half a century, the San Francisco Chronicle. And it's an items, daily items column. And he said, look, we're going to try it. If it doesn't work, you can go back to the business desk.
Well, it's amazing how many governors, presidents, LSU football coaches, and now publishers of the Baton Rouge Advocate.
Yeah,
you have outlasted.
Yeah, right. Well, I kind of just keep a low profile. So
a low profile on the front page of Section B.
Branders, he lay low.
You were 41 when you started this.
Yeah.
And you're still going.
Yeah, right. And I feel good. Clean living, of course, is my secret. And, early to bed and late to rise. And
with a few libations in between.
I have had an adult beverage on occasion, yes.
So, as most journalists do.
That's what I've heard.
At least the good ones.
Yeah, the industry has changed a lot, of course. You know, it's the old colorful guys with the hats, with the, press cards in them and all that. You don't really see it anymore. And the bottle in the bottom drawer, you don't have that. But it's settled down a lot.
It's in the top drawer now, right?
Yeah.
297-5633. Happy birthday to Smiley Anders. We have him on in November on his birthday, usually his real birthday, but this is the birthday of his column 35 years ago. Now, Johnny Carson only lasted 29 and a half years. David Letterman's going to hang it up next year after 33 years. Smiley Anders just goes on and on. This has to be one of the longest, if not the longest, columns in American journalism today.
I don't know if there's any research on that. I know Herb Cain did his for more than 50 years. He had started in his 20s, and he was still doing it when he died. So, I don't compare myself to Herb Cain, but that was the kind of column that he did.
And they have a Herb Cain Award for people who write columns like Smiley's, and what, 6 times you have won it?
Yeah, 5, I think. Yeah, the National Society of Newspaper Columnists. We're actually organized, which is kind of hard to believe. It's like organizing cats, I guess. But there is a group of columnists, and they used to have a category for items, columns, and then there were so few in the country that they finally just stopped the category after I'd won it about 5 times.
Well, Smiley lives in Spanish Town, and just as downtown started its renaissance, the Advocate moved away.
Don't get me started on the move. I was 6 blocks away from work. And
where the action is.
Strangely enough, they didn't come to me and ask me if it was okay with me if they moved. They just moved without my approval. So I'm still.
And it is somewhat appropriate that the Advocate, which is arguably, and I would certainly agree, the newspaper of record in Louisiana now.
Yeah, since we've moved to New Orleans.
That's right, and you're a daily, unlike the other paper in New Orleans, which is not a daily, at least not as far as what arrives on our doorstep.
It gave us an opening, and the man ships, and now Mr. George has jumped into it. And I've got readers now from the New Orleans area, the North Shore, and seems to be going great guns down there, and I get a lot of reaction from that area.
But you're renting office space from one of the world's best-known televangelists, Jimmy Lee Swaggart, who used to have a column in The Advocate like you. That didn't work out too well, did it?
Yeah, Brother Swaggart and I were colleagues.
You were fellow columnists. Did you ever compare notes?
No, I don't think I've ever met the gentleman, as a matter of fact.
And, the brother Swaggart, he's a guy who likes to dine out. He probably knows restaurants. He could write a restaurant column, but yeah. But I don't think he goes to some of the same places you and I do.
I've never seen him at the pastime, no, as a matter of fact. But although I have seen Governor McKithen there and Sheriff Litchfield and...
By the way, Governor McKithen died on this date 16 years ago. Yeah. He was an exceptional man. And Smiley Anders, 35 years, 1979, you started writing this column. And at that time, Edwin Edwards was finishing up his second term in office. The mayor of Baton Rouge was Woody Dumas.
That's right.
And a lot's happened since then.
Really has. It's been interesting times.
Now, Governor Edwards, like you, he likes the companionship of younger women. And he's got one who's 52 years his junior as his wife.
Right.
And I've reminded him that if he'd gone in the other direction, his wife would have been born circa 1876. But Lady Catherine has kind of corralled you.
Yes. I'm a very lucky man, as she reminds me every day. She's a great lady, and we have a lot of fun together.
And you've been together for a long time?
Yeah, since we started dating about 1991, mm-hmm. Got married in 1998.
But my guess is that she was not alive when you and Billy Cannon graduated from Estruma in 1955. And you wrote Smiley, of course, is known as a columnist, but he's an exceptional writer, and he wrote an exquisite profile of Estruma High School, class of 55. What a shame that high school is going by the wayside.
I hope they do something with it. As I understand, it's going to be closed for a year while they do something or figure out what to do with it. But it's a great old building, and it's not as majestic looking as Baton Rouge High, but it was a big school at the time.
If the walls could talk. Huh? If the walls could talk.
Yeah, boy.
And some of the conversations that you and young Billy had.
We had some great times. We really did. So, I still see Billy once in a
while. Speaking of Edwin Edwards, I saw Billy Cannon with him a few weeks ago by chance at an event, and they were seated together, and I thought, somebody needs to get that photo, and I wish I had, because they both looked great, and you got the most famous Louisiana politician and one of the world's truly great athletes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And both of them, of course, have a backstory that includes time in prison.
Yeah.
And the cut line or the caption would read, Twilight of the Gods.
They
looked fantastic, and those are two larger-than-life people that may not be around for another 35 years.
Larger-than-life really describes both of them, yeah.
But you've seen it all in Baton Rouge. You've rubbed shoulders with all the movers and shakers. There have been some exceptional people here who rose and fell. Pat Screen, think of him.
Yeah.
Man who had the potential to be anything he wanted to be.
Oh, absolutely. And he could have been, I believe he could have been governor.
No doubt.
He was on his way, I think.
And he died 20 years ago in New Orleans in a tragic way at the age of 51. But who's the most compelling figure you've covered over the last 35 years?
I guess Governor Edwards was the most polarizing. That was almost, you either loved him or hated him, you know, one or the other. There was very few middle grounds.
And so. He's still going.
Still going, yeah.
Edwin Washington Edwards, we're all going to be marked by him. And John McGinnis, certainly his career was marked by the times of Edwin Edwards, and what a loss we had with him.
Amazing. He was such a good guy, and just always the same, you know, just loved what he was doing.
What a void. What a void. But there will be a void when you go, and I don't think that's happening anytime soon, but my guess is that, and I don't mean to be morbid, Smiley, but my guess is that you'll die pen in hand. You'll be still writing your column.
Oh, yeah. They've already arranged for when I die. They've got enough room for the coffin to come in and get me out of the office. They've already measured the doors and the hallways, so they're going to just roll it in and roll me out. So,
Well, I asked Edwin Edwards on this show a few years ago after he got out of jail what would happen when he died, where he would go, and he says, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going in the ground. That's it. See you later. Good night. There is no life after this.
What do you think?
What do you think?
Well, yeah, I am. Obviously, I'm not sure. I don't think we know, but I think in case there is, we all just should live as good a life as we can here. And then in case there is afterlife, and if we get a break for being a good guy, so much the better. If it's not, well, goodbye.
I like your view of the higher power, the good guy break.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, you know, you did this, you did that, yeah. That wasn't so good, but hey, you're a pretty good guy, come
yeah.
on in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's my theology.
Have a seat at the bar.
Yeah, right.
Thank you, Smiley Anderson. Sure, thanks for 35 years of great words on page one of section B of the Baton Rouge Advocate. 6 days a week.
6 days
this
a
man
week.
Is relentless. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, for Frank Barnett, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.